Dr. Eric Turner, thank you for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure and an honor. I appreciate you being here. Can you tell us a little bit how effective are antidepressants for treating clinical depression?
Well, that is a big question. I think the answer would have to be that they're not as effective as we would like them to be. That's, I think everyone can agree upon that. And there is a debate as to how effective they are. It kind of depends upon if you have a certain threshold, you're using a certain threshold for what you consider, what the person in question is considering a clinically significant effect. Is it above that or below that? But I think there's some disagreement as to where that line should be. But I think most people can agree that, yeah, they're not as effective as we'd like them to be. And they're, I think the word modest is one that agrees. Some people would say that they're totally ineffective, but I can't agree with that. I would say they have, modest effects. And that is probably what explains the fact that we've observed, that we published on, and other people have published on, that in clinical trials, they don't, there's quite a few of them where they don't, the drug doesn't demonstrate statistical superiority to a placebo. And it turns out that happens about half the time, which is shocking when we first found that out not quite 20 years ago.
Half the time, yeah. Not quite 20 years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about your very well-cited, the 2008 published selective publication of antidepressant trials and its influence on apparent efficacy?
Yeah, that's... That at that time, the belief was that the antidepressants beat placebo all the time. And the reason for that, and I used to be under that impression as well. The reason for this is because if you read your average journal article, it couldn't miss. The drug always beat placebo in clinical trials. But then I went to the FDA and I worked there for 3 years as a reviewer. And one of my first assignments was to review an application by a drug company for a new antidepressant. And so I started going through the trials and I was wondering, what's going on here? There's all these negative trials and I'd never seen that before. And I asked my boss what the deal was. And he said, oh yeah, he's kind of chuckled and, oh yeah, it happens. He threw out a number of like 40%. Didn't quite get the humor in it because here I was also with a private practice on the side. And I thought as a person who prescribes these drugs, I should know, and my colleagues should know just the truth about these, that there's a lot of these trials that are where it's not demonstrating superiority to placebo. So that kind of provided the motivation to do this. That was part of it. There were other pieces of the puzzle. And so over the next a few years after I left the FDA, and I realized that people were still under the impression that they always beat placebo, and if I said to them that, well, actually, I learned otherwise at the FDA, and they kind of went, well, what are you talking about? The journal articles, and we all, believe the journal articles are the holy grail. I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, of course. The journal articles are telling us that they work all the time. So, who are you to say otherwise? So I realized that the only way they were going to believe me was if I published something and then they could respect it.
In the journal.
Yeah. So we took the FDA data, and the way we did that, the FDA actually posts its reviews of drugs that are once they are approved. And so we wound up getting the reviews on 12 antidepressants going back to Prozac. And it turned out there were 74 clinical trials that were done for those 12 drugs. And we tracked each of one of those trials into the published literature and asked, first of all, was it published at all? And if it was published, then was it published in a way that agreed with the FDA? And it turned out that there was quite a few that were, not published. And, like I think we said, a 50-50 basic breakdown in positive versus negative. And, and of the negative trials, they were divided between the ones that were not published and the ones that were, had been sort of reworked statistically through some hocus pocus, and having the result come out looking positive, and that is what got published.
50-50 with even some of the hocus pocus statistics that were done. Out of the 50% that did show efficacy, how many of those do you believe might have been manipulated in the research methodology, not the statistics part, but during the trials? Like, how many of them might have been manipulated to attempt the best effort of showing efficacy for the antidepressant being studied?
And we're talking about the ones that were negative according to the FDA. Is that right?
No, I'm thinking about the ones that actually showed positive results.
Well, the ones that showed positive results, I mean, I trust that they were positive because they were, the FDA gets notice of these trials before the trials even begin. So it's like a registration procedure. So they tell the FDA, first of all, number one, that the trial is going to take place, which is the reason why they can't later pretend that the trial never happened. And number two, they submit the protocol to the FDA. And the protocol has the details of sort of these nitty-gritty details about statistical methods, how many sites are going to be studied, what the rating scales are going to be, a large number of sort of fine-grained details, all of which can make a difference if you subsequently go back and you tweak. You say, well, let's look at this rating scale instead of the one that we said we were going to do. That's called outcome switching. But the FDA is sort of immune to outcome switching because they got that protocol up front. And the first thing that I was, back in the day when I was a reviewer, I was taught to do was to go back to the original protocol and, sort of review what the procedures, what they said the procedures were going to be before they even began the trial. Where the mischief happens is after, down the road, where the trial comes out not what as they had hoped, and maybe it came out, instead of coming out positive, as half of them did, it came out not statistically significant. And that's where, in the world of journal articles, they can submit something to the journals that where they have, as you say, reanalyze things using different, any number of different statistical techniques. Let's try this scale instead of the one we said we were going to do. come out, oh, well, yeah, now we got something that we can take to the bank. This will look much better. And then that gets submitted to the journal, and the people reviewing the journals, they don't know that this is, I mean, there are ways of knowing these days, but because we have registration at clinicaltrials.gov, but back then, there was really no way of checking that out, checking the veracity of they said they were going to do the scale. How do they know that that's what they were originally planning instead of change to after they saw the results?
Yeah. I've read before, and I'm still trying to, I don't have it down pat, but I've read people argue, for instance, that some of these clinical trials, even though they're approved by the FDA in the review process, let's say that the the group that they're going to try out this new antidepressant on, they are on antidepressants, and then they do an abrupt withdrawal, and then they put them on this new antidepressant, and so it's going to look a lot more efficacious than what it actually is, because it's not necessarily, it's like, have you heard of stuff like that happening?
There's the question of, I guess what we've been talking about up to now has been reporting bias and how the results are reported. But there's also questions of how the trials are designed in the first place. Is the deck stacked in favor of the drug or not? And I don't know that I've heard much about that. I mean, I've heard some about the idea. Could it be that people are in withdrawal, and then they're put on antidepressant, and then the. I guess that's possible. I think for the drugs that we were looking at, they were older ones, and I can't tell you whether they were drug naive or not. Or whether they were, if they had been off previous antidepressant for how long.
Yeah. I've heard of different techniques like doing that, or a placebo washout if somebody wasn't very placebo susceptible, they went ahead and put them out of the study. I needed to have this better, but yeah, I guess my first question was kind of the 50% that did show efficacious, how much confidence do we have that the studies were designed to be fair? Or I've heard that sometimes it's the pharmaceutical companies that design the studies. Mm-hmm. And of course they're going to try and show that their drug is better than a competitor's drug. And so sometimes the study design is in such a way that it's going to give them the best chance of their drug being shown to be superior to placebo or to a competitor's drug.
Mm-hmm. If it's obviously unfair, then the FDA has an opportunity to intervene before the trial, because as I mentioned a few moments ago, the drug company has to submit the protocol to the FDA, and the FDA, can look at it then and say, "Hey, wait a minute, you can't do it that way. That's not kosher." How often does that actually happen? Number one, how often does it happen that they wind up stacking the design of the trial, and then assuming that that happens, how often does the FDA give them feedback? I'm not really sure of those two things.
Okay. And so in your publication bias study, you found, 50% of these studies are not even showing a positive result. And you all published that in 2008. Since then, do you think prescribing has kind of stayed the same or ramped up, or did that have an impact on, maybe they're not as efficacious as we thought, so maybe we shouldn't prescribe quite as vigorously as we used to? Or, do you have any sense of what impact that had on actual clinical practice?
I think we got, I'm not sure what I don't know. I can't tell you what the numbers are, but I think we got a couple of countervailing forces, if that's the right word. You got the word getting out that the drugs aren't as effective as we used to think they were. But at the same time, you've got these marketing machines of the pharmaceutical companies, and they're cranking out new drugs, they're putting ads on TV, and they're expanding the reach. They've been expanding the reach to other fields within medicine. It used to be that antidepressants were almost entirely prescribed by psychiatrists. There were some few general practitioners that were prescribing it, but it was more because back before Prozac, look at historically, before Prozac and Zoloft, the SSRIs, you had the tricyclic antidepressants, and those had more side effects than the so-called second generation antidepressants. So I think largely for that. I think other fields within medicine were scared of prescribing them. They thought, oh, we better leave that to the psychiatrist. That's, that's kind of potentially dangerous stuff. We better, be sure it's the people that do this as their specialty. But then the second generation antidepressants came along with, fewer side effects of the type that could cause death and potentially cardiac side effects, for instance. But there were other more everyday side effects that were bothersome as well, like dry mouth, so-called anticholinergic side effects. And it all made it, they were able to pitch it to general practitioners, internists, and family practitioners and so on as being, hey, you could do this too. And so these days, antidepressants, I don't know what the breakdown is, but I think probably antidepressants are more widely prescribed by non-psychiatrists than by psychiatrists. So anyway, that's a long way of answering your question that I think, yes, maybe the word's gotten out that they're not the greatest, drugs in the world, but at the same time, you got a lot more people out there prescribing it. Some who may not be aware of these issues. They just know that, as you get out into other disciplines, you might have less awareness of the questions about efficacy.
How has it influenced your prescribing practice? Is that okay to ask?
Sure. I do still, I do prescribe them. I don't, I think I'm more circumspect, excuse me, about prescribing them and less optimistic about it. And I go ahead and I convey that to patients. And let them know that, don't expect miracles here. You may be, you could be, one of the, you could be a rare lucky person who has just a tremendous response to the first drug we try, but we might, don't be shocked and terribly disappointed if it doesn't work for you. And I'm saying work as a binary thing. There's an issue there because efficacy it's often portrayed as something black or white. Either you respond or you don't respond, or you have a remission or you have no response at all. But the fact is it's on a scale or on a continuum. It's more like instead of a on off light switch, it's more like a dimmer switch. And some people might have a partial response. some people have, may have, anyway, all sorts of grades of response in there.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Irving Kirsch at all and his work?
Somewhat.
Yeah, I was just curious because I think, that 2008 article that I mentioned just a few moments ago, that was around the same time. Irving Kirsch, I think, was publishing around that time, 2012. And he was doing some systematic reviews, and his conclusion was kind of that antidepressants are not much better than placebo. But it seems like you're mentioning that, in fact, maybe they are.
Yeah, his group's paper came out with, it came out 5 weeks, almost to the day from our 2008 article, and their article, I think the title of it was The Initial Severity of Depression and Antidepressant Response. So they looked at, how depressed people were at their baseline before they went on antidepressants, and they found that if people were severely depressed or, moderately to severely depressed, then they would have a response. On the other hand, if they were sort of the mild to moderate category, I forget where they try to draw a line, if you're in the mild category, it's, you're not going to get, much distinction from placebo.
And have you kind of seen that play out in real world experience, or does that impact your prescribing practice much? If someone has more of a severe depression, you're more likely to prescribe, or?
Yeah, I think we had a real debate back then because they went, You know, I think that's definitely a valid point looking at initial severity, and other people have done it since. But one of the issues that came up was this notion of a, I think they kind of went to the point of saying that they just don't work. It was more of a binary thing. They don't. And the reason that the way they came up with that was invoking a cutoff for a clinically significant effect. So a, and I think we might have touched on this earlier, but the idea of a clinically significant effect is, it's a great idea in principle, but the field hasn't agreed on what constitutes a clinically significant effect. And like, if you have a mild response or a partial response to an antidepressant, I mean, if you had a complete response, it totally wipes away your symptoms. And I think everybody can agree that that is clinically significant. If they have, if their depressive symptoms come down by 50%, that's technically called a response by a classic definition, 50% decrease from baseline. Hopefully most people can agree that that's nothing to dismiss, but anyway, it gets a little bit, don't mean to get too much in the weeds here, but they used an effect size of 0.5, and we had found that I think we both actually agreed the effect size that we got, the overall effect size, the number that we both got was around 0.3. I think we got 0.31 and Kirsch got 0.32. So we couldn't agree any better on that. The where things diverged was in how that got interpreted. They said, well, 0.32 is less than 0.5. Therefore, it has no clinically significant effect. But the question is, who said that 0.5 was a litmus test for a clinically significant effect? And keep in mind also just another complication that we're talking about population. We're talking about large hundreds of people in these clinical trials. These are average effects, whereas the individuals are kind of all over the place. You have some with large effects and some with really teeny tiny effects, maybe some with no effects. This 0.5, this idea that 0.5 is a threshold was kind of made up. There's a history as to where that originated from, and I don't want to get already in the weeds a bit, so don't want to even get deeper into it, but happy to if you want to. I would took issue with the 0.5 cutoff or litmus test for clinical significance. That's how they, in my understanding, came up with saying that they don't reach that threshold, therefore they don't work. I mean, truth is, antidepressants are not alone in not reaching 0.5. I mean, antipsychotics, we looked at those later, the effect size there was 0.4. Shall we stop prescribing antipsychotics to people who are, hallucinating and paranoid and so on? There's a lot of drugs that don't reach 0.5. It's not just antidepressants.
That's a good, I wanted to ask, I see a lot of your work is on antidepressants, and I think that's what you said you were kind of, that's what you studied during your FDA review process. But are you also, have you done publication bias studies with antipsychotics as well?
We had a paper in the journal Ms. PLOS Medicine in 2012, I believe, and it was looking at antipsychotics. And we found a similar kind of a similar thing going on as with the antidepressants, although not quite as stark, because as I mentioned, the effect size is actually a bit higher for antipsychotics than it is for antidepressants. It's still not 0.5, but it's 0.4, and there's still this, there were some negative trials that were not getting published, and just not to the degree that we saw with the antidepressants.
The whole publication file drawer effect, is that being worked on? Is that, now that we know that that's a problem, are there going to be kind of laws set in place where that's not going to happen so much anymore?
We're working on it. Now, there have been things that have been put in place, but we still got a ways to go. I mean, the probably the biggest thing that's been done has been the your registration of trials in you know, in registries. So, like clinicaltrials.gov is the one that's the best, you know, the best known. So that way you can. I mean, they didn't. Clinicaltrials.gov didn't really get rolling. It was started in the early 2000s, but it didn't really get rolling until like 2005 and six and beyond that. So now you can, you know, there's some sort of paper trail for clinical trials. You can, you know, every trial that gets published has a. You can track it back in clinicaltrials.gov, and often in the abstract they list the what's called the NCT number, which is just the clinicaltrials.gov number, and you can go look it up. And you could compare the, you know, look for any shenanigans, you know, in the outcome, you know, look for outcome switching. I'll give you another term that's maybe a little catchier: harking. Harking stands for hypothesizing after the results are known. So you can go back and you can look at the original outcomes that were planned before they started the study, and you know, in clinicaltrials.gov, and make sure that they didn't change. Now, what if the drug company doesn't publish a trial? How would you know to go look for it? How do you know what you're not even thinking about? That's the trickier thing. But in theory, you could go, if you had a particular drug in mind, you could go into clinicaltrials.gov and search under that, and you could see, and you could do kind of what I did with the FDA data. Instead, you could establish your cohort of trials that were done. So instead of going to FDA review documents, you could go to clinicaltrials.gov and, you know, identify for this new drug, here are all the trials that were done, and then you go look for them in the literature and, you know, see if they were, you know, published, you know, properly and in agreement with, where you might find, well, wait a minute, how come this one never got published? What's going on there? So anyway, clinicaltrials.gov is sort of the long answer to your question, but that is a major way that it makes it almost impossible to hide the existence of trials. And it also makes it easier to find out if trials, if there's been outcome switching or harking. There's another approach which I'm quite excited about, and I hope it catches hold more. It's primarily being used in the domain of psychology, and being a psychologist yourself, you might be a little bit closer to this. There's an approach called registered reports, and it was the person who has provided the is really spearheaded the effort more than anyone has been someone named Chris Chambers. He's in Cardiff in Wales, University of Cardiff in Wales, and what registered reports are journal articles where things kind of go. In a way, similar to the FDA method, things get someone doing a trial, and it doesn't have to be a clinical trial. There's other various other study types that get published via registered reports as well, but they submit their plan to the journal or a preprint platform, one of the two. And they get reviewed at so-called a stage one peer review. So they get a peer review at that stage before they even do the trial. And then the reviewers, if they agree that this, you know, looks like, so they're focused on the rationale for the study and also the methodological rigor that, is this good? And basically addressing the question, is this good science or is it not good science? And importantly, there are no results at that stage because it's, as I said, it's before the study is done. So they then render a decision, and it's called a stage one in principle acceptance. So the study is accepted for publication at that stage. And then the investigators go out and they do the study, and they may get results that are statistically significant, or they may not get significant results. They then write up their results and they submit it back to the journal again with the results. And if the results are if they're negative or non-significant, the journal can't say, the journal reviewers, actually some have tried this, but then they get told that, no, you can't do that. But if the journal were to say, oh, wait a minute, the results are negative, maybe this isn't such good science after all, they can't. They already rendered that decision because when they, their opinions must not, the goal is to make it so the results, whether they're positive or negative, can't dictate or influence their publication decision.
Well, that's so good.
I like this register reports. A lot of psychology journals are participating in that. I think there's over 300 journals overall that are participating in this approach. And
good.
Probably the lion's share of them are psychology, but I would really like to see that move into clinical trials.
Yeah, wow. This is kind of a different topic. Well, hang on before we get there. Have you also looked into the effects of psychotherapy and publication bias in that area?
Thanks for asking. Because one of the outcomes of the Kirsch paper that we talked about a few minutes ago was that people were saying, aha, antidepressants don't work. Therefore, everyone should do psychotherapy. And I'm going, oh, wait a minute, how do we know that there's no publication? The premise of that is that there's no publication bias with psychotherapy. So, I joined with some, actually several psychologists, and I think the year of the publication was around 2012, maybe 13, something like that. So we, colleagues, there was one at Vanderbilt and the rest of them were in the Netherlands. And so what we did is we took a similar, the short answer is yes, there is publication bias with antidepressants. Rather, get right to the point. I can tell you how we did that because there's no FDA for psychotherapy studies. So, so we used, I'll go ahead and blurt it out. The goal was, I was hoping that we could find what's called an inception cohort of trials. That's to identify the trials before they're started, because that's the key. That back before the study is started, that's when everyone's hopeful and they have nothing to feel ashamed about. So we used NIH grants, and it turns out the NIH has a grants database, and you can look up. And so we looked up and found all the grants that were funding clinical trials to look at psychotherapy and things like cognitive behavioral therapy, interpersonal therapy, and so on. I think there were five different antidepressants five different psychotherapies that we looked at, and then we similarly tracked those into the literature, and we found out there were actually three quarters of them were published, and almost a quarter of them were not published. So some of the authors tracked down the ones that were unpublished, and we got some data from many of those investigators, I think almost all the investigators, and reanalyzed the data, and it brought down the effect size from what it had been. Importantly, we were sort of accepting the you know, so non-publication is the, you know, was the one quarter piece of it, but among the other three quarters that were published, you know, we were unable to question whether those were all truly positive as they appeared to be in the published literature. See, with FDA reviews, you can see the FDA's version of it, but with psychotherapy trials, you're stuck. Mm-hmm. You're stuck with what's in the journal articles, and you don't have any alternate sense or source of data.
Yeah,
you'd have to get the protocols and the original protocols for those studies, and we tried to get those from NIH, and we couldn't get them.
Mm. It's so tricky. I'm not PhD, so my program was focused more on clinical, and we did, you know, a research methodology class, and we have to do a dissertation, but we're not extensively research oriented. And you can find, so I do a lot of reading on like psychodynamic psychotherapy, for instance, and there's Jonathan Shedler. He is a big advocate for psychodynamic therapy, and he's done talks and presentations on the research that purportedly shows CBT to be more efficacious in psychodynamic therapy. And he's talked about the research and how they were manipulated to show, you know, the therapists who were doing CBT, they were like trained by, you know, not Judith Beck, but, you know, some CBT. And then the therapist who did psychodynamic psychotherapy in that study, they had like a 1 day class on it from like an intern or something. And it's already set up to where. So he was just kind of talking about, you have to really look into the research. And it just seems also like, you know, Irving Kirsch or people like Dr. Peter Bregan or like, anyone who has their own kind of views can say, well, this research is flawed or this research is no good. And here's other research that shows this. And so I'm just having a really hard time trying to hone in on, especially when all of these very much research oriented scientists can't even really agree on the research. It's kind of like, well, when it comes to the social sciences, I'm not too sure how much confidence to place in research articles and journals and does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. So yeah, there's my research has primarily been on, you could call it selective publication, you know, picking and choosing what you're going to publish and how you're going to publish it. But there's a loosely related phenomenon called selective citation. So you can pick and choose who you cite and what you cite, you know, whatever supports your case. And this is not, you know, restricted to science. I mean, you would, in medicine, it's sort of, I mean, you could kind of think about even politics. I mean, probably, you know, people are going to pick and choose what they're going to focus on and, you know, turn on this channel and you get these stories, you turn on that channel, you get these other stories. And how come, you know, I'm not hearing about this story on this other channel? So it's kind of, in a way, we kind of think that research is supposed to be above all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But the sad truth that there's, you know, people are human. humans are people. Another issue with, you know, psychotherapy trials is, I mean, you were asking earlier about the, you know, bias in the design, how a trial is designed, and how that can influence the results. Well, you know, when it comes to psychotherapy trials, you've got, I think what you were getting at a moment ago was there's the question of investigator allegiance, as it's called. So the person doing the trial, they might have an axe to grind that they are a champion of CBT, or they might be a champion of interpersonal psychotherapies, and they're the ones, you know, setting up the trial. But then once the trial gets going, there's not much blinding going on. I mean, how do you blind someone to Well, let's put it this way. If you're doing interpersonal psychotherapy or CBT versus treatment as usual or wait list, how do you possibly blind that? How does a person, gosh, I wonder if I'm getting active treatment. They're on a wait list and they're not seeing anyone. I wonder if I'm in the inactive group or the active treatment group. So you've got the blinding of the patient is an issue. And then you got the investigator. So the investigator is administering a type of therapy that he or she believes pretty strongly in. Is that going to have some sort of an effect on the outcome? So they're not blind to the, ideally you want to blind the investigator as well as the patient. And that's, why we call it double blind.
That's a really good point. I hadn't really thought about double blind in terms of psychotherapy research.
Yeah, because it never gets talked about. They'll say, we did an RCT, blah, blah, and they'll throw out RCT. Like, and we're supposed to say, RCT was done, therefore it's rigorous. But you can do RCT a lot of things, and it's not, if it's not blinded, it's good that it was great that it's randomized, but it was unblinded, that's a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
Now, and back to medicine and pharmaceutical trials where, we got psychedelic drugs now and, very little, not much blinding going on there either. The person's either getting placebo or they're getting, say, MDMA or psilocybin, and they're basically tripping. Is that going to, how's that not going to influence their impression of how they respond and how they recall that they respond and how the investigators as well, they see this, a reaction within the patient. And it's, anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
So the blinding is a big, can definitely, or lack of blinding can definitely affect results.
Yeah. No, I saw this little like cartoon comic where it's kind of these people in a room and
I've seen that one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's got some people, I think they're like up and dancing and then the other ones are sitting in the chair. Like, I wonder what group we're in.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great one.
If I can just for a moment, going back to kind of the, me trying to sift through the research and you can kind of find whatever you're looking for. And I've heard stories from some of these books that I've read that are a little bit more, I would say, anti or critical psychiatry leaning. And, they'll talk about stories, which I'm sure there are, you can find these stories anywhere. Again, whatever you're looking for, you'll find it. But they'll talk about stories where someone was perhaps on antidepressants or antipsychotics for 5-10 plus years, and their life was, they weren't doing well. Maybe they were on disability. Their relationships were all kind of everywhere. And then they slowly started tapering off. And once they tapered off the medication, they started having a new sense of livelihood and they got the help they needed and they rebuilt their relationships and now they're out working. And they'll kind of make cases like that where how many people are being medicated when maybe that's not what it's. And I don't know, I guess for you, someone who's actually, you don't have to just rely on what stories that you hear because you prescribe. Can you kind of find stories like that where maybe someone's come to you and you're like, yeah, maybe this was a misdiagnosis or you're on the wrong medication, or maybe you don't need medication at all. Let's see if we can taper you off of here. And then they started doing better can you talk a little bit about that in your own experience?
I mean, I guess I think you're asking more about someone who's on antidepressants and maybe they, but I'm thinking of more, I think what we see more in psychiatry is where people maybe wind up on antidepressants when they, it's not just a lack of benefit, a little bit stronger case, like say that they have, maybe they weren't adequately assessed in the past for bipolar disorder. And antidepressants can worsen bipolar disorder. They can trigger manic episodes, and they can also cause cycle acceleration in someone who already has bipolar disorder. So, a person like that would probably be, maybe when they were first seen, if they were maybe not, asked all the right questions, maybe, and the patient just said they were depressed, and maybe gave a few other symptoms, but they weren't asked enough other questions to make a determination as to whether they might have bipolar disorder. Then, and if they do have it, then antidepressants are actually a very bad thing to have, usually to have people on. Now, sometimes people with bipolar disorder do wind up on antidepressants if they wind up, they should at least be on a mood stabilizer, something that would protect against manic episodes and rapid cycling, ideally. But, I'm talking about like an initial case where a person was, they got put on antidepressants and they got manic and something like that.
Yeah. I've heard of an argument that if you look up on some of these antidepressants, one of the possible side effects is mania, and that it's not actually that it has uncovered an underlying bipolar depression. It's just that they were put in antidepressants and now they had a side effect, which is mania. And now they're being diagnosed bipolar instead of major depressive disorder. But it's not an underlying diagnosis. It's a side effect. And now we're going to be putting them on mood stabilizers and have you?
I don't buy that. I mean, if a person gets manic upon first contact with an antidepressant, I mean, there's so many people that does not happen to. But it happened. Let's say that it happens to a couple people in 100 that you give, or let's say 5 people in 100 that you give antidepressants to. Well, there's something different about these 5 people compared to the other 95 people that caused them to get manic. I mean, if you were to believe that antidepressants cause mania in a person that has no predisposition for bipolar disorder, then it would have to be all 100 people and not just a select few.
That's interesting, because go ahead.
I mean, you can think of bipolar, and there are other people that are more expert on this about, there's a notion of bipolar spectrum, and we talked about efficacy earlier, about efficacy being on a spectrum. Well, bipolar disorder, one's predilection to bipolar disorder arguably lies along a spectrum as well. You got the people who are full-fledged, got rip-roaring manic episodes, and everyone agrees that they've, and maybe they never were exposed to an antidepressant. There's a lot of people, like that. And then there's other people who, no matter what, they'll never get manic, and you can give them antidepressants, you can give them maybe combination therapy at maximal doses, and nothing happens. And then you got maybe people somewhere in the middle who have a predisposition, and maybe they have a family history of someone in the family who got sometimes how you can get some sense of what the predisposition is if they have a positive family history. And then, but maybe the person has no personal history of a manic episode, but the straw that breaks, along comes an antidepressant, and that could be the straw that breaks the camel's back and puts them over the line, and then they have their first ever episode. Or maybe it's not a full-fledged manic episode. Maybe it's a hypomania instead. But
Okay. Have you heard of, I've heard also of kind of this difference, there's the one lens maybe that fits along with the medical model of psychiatric medications are, if you look at it from a disease model, there's an underlying disease, and the psychiatric medications are trying to correct something or do something to try and counterbalance the disease or cure the disease or cure the symptom, or at least, you know, rid the symptoms that the disease is bringing about. And then there's kind of there's the disease model, and then there's like the drug model, the medication model, which would be more like they're not curative. They do have an impact. Like antipsychotics have a tranquilizing impact, and a tranquilizing impact might someone who's hallucinating, or, you know, it might kind of impact them in a way that lessens their symptoms, but it's not that the drug is acting on the disease. It's that mm-hmm. the drug has a, have you kind of heard that difference before, or does that make sense to you?
It does. I'm thinking of it more in terms of if we go back to bipolar mania, for instance, and if you have a person who's gotten manic and they have a decreased need for sleep, being one of the best ways of best symptoms that you can hang your hat on as far as making the diagnosis, if you had to pick one, decreased need for sleep. So they have, you know, lots of energy and they're go, go, go. But they just, you know, most people would be totally exhausted by a couple of nights without sleep, but they're doing just fine. Thank you. And they're not slowing down. It turns out there's sort of a vicious cycle with this insomnia and this lack of sleep, because that in itself, lack of sleep has its own antidepressant effect and a tendency to perpetuate or trigger off a manic episode. You could got my dog there wandering around. if you'll excuse that. Anyway, if you could take a person with, you know, mania, and one of the symptoms that you're counting in your rating scale is their insomnia and their decreased need for sleep, and if you give them something very sedating, like quetiapine, you know, Seroquel is the brand name, or olanzapine, and you basically make them sleep, well, right there you've got some, you're getting improvement on your mania rating scale just from that alone. So that could, and it may not, you know, be getting at the core, the core of the illness. But truth be told, I kind of have wondered often over the years, what if you gave a person like that, you just gave them, made them sleep through some drug that we don't even think about as being a psychiatric drug, like Ambien or Benadryl. Benadryl, antihistamine, but it has sedating effects. Yeah. You just make the person sleep. And I think you're sort of breaking the cycle you may wind up actually breaking this sort of vicious cycle of the lack of sleep and the mania. And because one of the, you know, people do seem to get better just being on a hospital unit sometimes, because then they got a sort of routine, and someone tells them, you know, it's time to go to bed, and everyone's going to bed, and, you know, they don't have to go to bed, but, you know, it's a lot easier to, to sort of go with the flow in a case like that, as opposed to being at home when they might, oh, I think I'll go for a joyride, go speeding around the neighborhood, go to the casino, see how much money I can make.
No, I like that idea. And I think that's a perfect example of thinking of it through like a drug model versus a disease model, where let's say someone has in the middle of a bipolar episode, it's not like, oh, we have this medication is approved for bipolar, and this is the only thing that we can use. This treats the disease. But it's like, no, what drug effect are we looking for here? And what else can we, like, if you can use something like Benadryl and that's going to have a lot less negative side effects perhaps than some of these other. So I like, yeah, that's, I like that idea. And if you don't mind, while we're on this topic, I see that you've, where is it? It's right. A treatment of a rapidly cycling bipolar patient by using extended bed rest and darkness to stabilize the timing and duration of sleep. Can you talk a little mm-hmm. bit about that one?
That was in my pre-FDA days. That was at NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health, the intramural division. And that's a case report. And people sometimes they don't respect case reports as much as clinical trials, where you've got hundreds of people perhaps. But so this is just one case. But sometimes case reports can be very interesting and lead to clinical trials down the road. But this is a patient with, as it says, rapid cycling bipolar disorder. And he was sort of doing his own thing with, he never got seriously manic. He got only hypomanic, but he would cycle into these depressive episodes. And it was almost like clockwork. And you could, had a certain periodicity to it. And so what he would do left to his own devices at home, he would just sort of get, when he got depressed, he would sleep like 16 hours a day. Which probably like a vicious cycle, made the depression even worse because you get, when you're sleeping all the time, you're withdrawn from people, you're not getting stimulation. But he would eventually switch and he would go into a hypomanic episode. And then he would like, hey, I'm going to make hay while the sun shines. And he would, be up most hours of the night doing various, he was self-employed and he was working on his own business. He'd be working on his taxes, doing this and that and the other. And that decreased, that lack of sleep had a reinforcing effect on the hypomania and kept it going a bit. So what we did is we brought him into the inpatient unit and basically kind of clamped his or used the kind of environmental solution to his extreme variability in his sleep duration, sleep versus wake, sleep wake cycle. So he we had certain hours that he was supposed to be on the inpatient unit. I think he was supposed to report in around 4 p.m. and had to be in there till 8 a.m., a long, rather long night, but he had to be at least trying to sleep even if he didn't feel like sleeping. And then when the morning came, it was up and at him, go for a hike around the campus, the NIH campus, or if you need to go home and do something, that's fine, but, be back here at the end of the day. So he had to be active during the day, and then he was forced to be inactive during the night, whether he felt like it or not. So instead of going with the flow, he kind of had to go against it. His cycling really smoothed out quite a lot. It was remarkable, and it seemed to be, more effective than any medication that he had been on before, based upon the data that we had collected for quite some time before we ever brought him into an inpatient. So it turns out there is a type of psychotherapy that is related to this and called behavioral activation for depression.
Oh.
So that's basically, a lot of times when people get depressed, they don't do anything. They don't feel like doing anything, and they just go with that. So they don't do anything. But behavioral activation, they kind of have to commit to doing certain things and meet with the therapist, and I think they interviewed them. I haven't sat in on a session, but I took place in a, I referred quite a few patients to a study that took place where I used to work. So they would meet with the patient. They said, what do you like to do? They, ask about their hobbies and things they like to do and so on. And they would schedule. They wind up, okay, when would you like to do that? What days of the week are you going to do that? and say, oh, maybe Monday, Wednesday, Friday. What time on Monday, Wednesday, Friday? And then they would, you know, 10 o'clock say, okay, it's here it is on your schedule. And they'd wind up filling up, you know, putting these things on the patient's schedule. And they actually seemed to help. Quite a bit. Unfortunately, when they ended the study, they went back to their own devices, and they didn't have anyone to be accountable to, and they often relapsed.
Yeah,
or lost whatever gains that they had had.
Yeah, it's hard. For some people, that internal motivation can come easily, and some people need kind of external motivation. I don't know what you would do there.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this has been very interesting. I appreciate you coming on to talk about some of these important topics and help me sift through, and any of my listeners that are interested in this, I'm sure that they've gotten a lot from this. It's a very interesting work that you've done, and I think we need more of that kind of work. And I hope that this all kind of, we move in a direction of more clarity and more honest publication and results and, Yeah.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me there. And I definitely hope we moved in these directions as well. Thing that I'm most optimistic about is the more widespread adoption of registered reports and psychology studies and pharmaceutical studies as well.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Turner, thanks for being on here. I appreciate it.
All right. You're very welcome.